KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Highs in the upper 40s.
It's an exciting sport already. You don't need something to take you over the edge. I knew I couldn't do it personally because of my health issues, but other guys think that, hey, if I could get locked in on you for 3 hours, it's a bonus.
Governments must stick to the tasks and timetables that are necessary for an adequate response to climate change.
Well, you know, I just started kind of reviewing the past year and thinking about what varieties did well for me and kind of what I want to do next year while it's still fresh in my mind.
Athletes are using Adderall to help enhance their performance. We'll find out why. We're also going to wrap up our gardening. But first, we're going to take a look at what's happening with the latest round of climate change talks. For 20 years now, representatives from countries around the world have gathered to discuss and come up with policies around climate change. The United Nations Climate Change Conference convened this week in Doha, Qatar. Dr. Beth Sawin is co-director of Climate Interactive, a scientist, writer, teacher, public speaker. She's been working on these issues for the past 15 years. She joins us from Vermont. Thanks for talking to us, Dr. Sawin.
My pleasure.
The first meeting, 1990, the Earth Summit, was held in Rio. That was when the United Nations framework, the Convention on Climate Change, was formed. We got the Kyoto Protocols. What have these UN meetings accomplished since then?
Well, on the one hand, not very much. So over these past 20 years, greenhouse gas emissions have been steadily increasing despite these talks. A new analysis just came out from the World Meteorological Organization. They said that in 2011, we had record CO2 concentrations, 391 parts per million. In 1992, when the UN climate talk process got kicked off, CO2 was at around 356 parts per million. To put that in perspective, pre-industrial CO2 concentrations were 280 parts per million. So in the 240 years from the beginning of industrialization till those first climate talks, humanity added 76 parts per million to the atmosphere. And then in those 20 years while since the talks began, we've added another 35 parts per million.
So, you know, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, if you think about being, say you're 76 pounds overweight and then you gain another 35 pounds while you're thinking about dieting, that's one way to think about these talks. So on the other hand, there's been a lot that has been accomplished. So first of all, there are actual pledges. Starting in the Copenhagen round, countries around the world have committed to reduce emissions. Analysis by our groups and others say those reductions aren't ambitious enough to meet all of our climate goals, but they definitely are progress. The other thing that happens at these climate talks is thousands of civil society people and youth leaders and environmentalists meet around the edges of the negotiations, and new ideas and connections and collaborations and coalitions are built.
Have you seen those new ideas or coalitions bear fruit in changing government policy on emissions?
Well, I mean, I think some of the things that you see are some of the countries that lead by example. So, for example, Germany, which is now up to something like 25% of its energy coming from renewables, and they're surpassing all of their benchmarks toward their goal of 80% renewables by 2050. Other countries get to hear about the progress being made by Germany at these talks or presentations about things like that. And so the sense of aspiration and possibility can be increased in that way. There's also sort of sometimes unlikely coalitions. So last year in the South Africa round of negotiations, the European Union and some of the poorest countries in the world found themselves allied on the need to make the pledges more ambitious than they currently were.
Now, part of that stems from what happened in Copenhagen in 2009, which was viewed as a failure by a lot of people. The president submitted a voluntary plan to cut emissions after that round did not get support for mandatory emissions restrictions. What did you see coming out of Copenhagen, and have there been any policy changes along the lines of what you just discussed, but have there been real changes since Copenhagen?
Well, one of the important things Copenhagen did was it established a goal of limiting temperature increase to 2 degrees centigrade, which is about 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, over pre-industrial temperatures. So all the countries of the world agreed to that goal in Copenhagen. The year after that in Cancun, those voluntary pledges that you mentioned in Copenhagen were codified into part of the UN climate treaty framework. Then last year in Durban, South Africa, the countries of the world agreed to put in place by 2015 a global treaty that would come into force in 2020. And the new thing about that treaty is that it would include not just the developed countries, but also the major emitters among developing countries.
And countries like China have agreed to that?
That's right.
Then we have to see the policy that follows. China is in some ways seen as a leader in renewables. Are they visibly reducing their emissions or on a track to reduce their emissions by 2020?
No, China's commitment to the Copenhagen round was to reduce their what they're called emissions intensity. So that's their amount of emissions per unit of GDP. Because GDP is growing so quickly in China, that means emissions will still go up, but they'll go up less than they otherwise would have. And you're definitely right that in many ways China is breaking new grounds in terms of the rate of scale-up of renewable energy, partly for climate change goals, but also I understand from talking to Chinese scientists, partly because they really understand that leadership in the new emerging economy is going to depend upon mastering these renewable energy technologies. And so China finds that very aligned with their economic interests as well.
Dr. Beth Solomon is co-director of Climate Interactive. The group is tracking what is happening in the Doha rounds of United Nations climate change talks. The goal of these meetings are in part to replace the Kyoto agreements, some of which some countries didn't ever ratify. I think we know about that. Including us, but many of the countries, do they seem to you to be backing away from a pledge to an actual cap? And if that's the case, what do policymakers think are going to come out of these Doha meetings?
Well, the things that we're looking for out of the Doha meetings, I would say, are strengthening the existing pledges. So these are pledges many countries have made through 2020. Analysis by our groups and others say that those pledges leave a gap of about 18% to 30% of where emissions need to be in 2020. So the first thing is make those pledges stronger. So far, governments haven't shown much appetite for increasing that. The consequence if we don't meet the 2020 targets is either that 2-degree goal that was ratified or agreed to in Copenhagen will be out of reach, or after 2020, action to reduce emissions will have to be much faster than it otherwise would be, and faster reductions transfers into more expensive and more disruptive, more decarbonization at a faster pace. So that's why the most important goal out of these continuing rounds is increasing the ambition towards 2020. That could happen if countries strengthen their existing pledges. Could happen if countries that haven't yet made pledges step forward with pledges. And there's a lot of hopes that Qatar, the host of the talks this round, who hasn't actually made a pledge, as the host, they might step forward and do that. And then the final area is that some emissions aren't covered within these national emissions, particularly international shipping and aviation. So that's another place where some analysts see potential for getting closer to the 2020 targets.
In terms of, you know, what makes sense for countries, didn't the European Union try to come up with a plan for charging people for airline emissions, for aviation emissions, and haven't they had to back off on that because it was pretty expensive for the consumer?
They have had to back off for it. I'm not sure how much that really would have changed the price of an airplane ticket, but there was really strong opposition from the United States to that, I think, on grounds of principle. Unfortunately, that pathway forward seems to be blocked for now.
Well, on that, so Climate Interactive has performed some model simulations looking at the global energy system, looking for ways toward improving governments' ability to cut their emissions. And the work has shown all successful paths tend to include three components: more energy efficiency, more use of renewable energy, and some kind of cost attached to carbon dioxide emissions. Especially on that last one, is there support among these countries to actually tackle putting a cost on carbon dioxide that everybody would buy into?
Well, what we see now is that some countries are experimenting with this at the national level. So we have see Australia now with carbon tax. China actually in some cities is experimenting with that. Maybe you're asking about the idea of a global carbon price. Is that what you're wondering about?
Well, individually, if countries put a tax on their carbon, they end up, don't they, in some form of a competitive disadvantage? Doesn't everybody at some point have to come up with a price on carbon that works all around the world?
Yeah, that would be the most logical result, because as you point out, if some countries are taking into account the cost of carbon and others aren't, there's a fear that particularly carbon-intensive industries would migrate to the countries with the lowest cost. It seems like for now the route is for countries to experiment individually with this, and there's a lot of advantages, particularly because when I was talking about China in some ways winning this race toward developing low-carbon technologies. Anything that orients an economy towards becoming smarter towards these new technologies in the end is probably going to give them an advantage.
You've worked on this enough time to get a sense of what these rounds feel like. Some people say that in part the election turned as the reality-based community saw what climate change might mean for weather and how it impacts coastal communities in America, in your area, in Vermont, in part, and further south. What's your sense of how these actual policies might emerge from Doha, given what seems to be the United States, at least begrudgingly, coming around to accept that the science is the science?
Well, I think what we are seeing is that climate change is no longer some distant problem that we're trying to prevent, but it's also something we're feeling the impacts of every day. So you mentioned the Superstorm Sandy in New York, something like $42 billion in damage. Estimates of the U.S. drought this year, $20 billion in damages. Now, those things weren't caused by climate change, but the consensus emerging is that they were likely made stronger because of climate change. So those are real dollars and real costs that are impacting people today. And so in this equation of putting resources towards turning away from fossil fuels, it's beginning to make more and more and more sense. And I think that is going to open up new possibilities, both in national policies and in the global talks. Maybe not this year, but I think in the near future.
Why not this year, do you think?
I think by the time that you get to one of these rounds of climate negotiations, pretty much what countries are willing to do has already been determined. And so I'm not sure that recent weather events like storms on the U.S. East Coast are going to change much in that sort of short time horizon.
So put this Doha round in perspective for me. What is its function and its purpose at this point, and what marker could it put down that would be most effective from your perspective with Climate Interactive going into the future?
Well, of course, we would love to see countries increasing the ambition of their 2020 pledges. There hasn't been much signaling that that's likely to happen. Developing countries are really looking towards the richest countries in the world to stand behind commitments they've made for what's called climate finance, so funding both for developing low-carbon economies and for helping countries cope with the impacts of climate change. It seems important that the rich countries stand behind those promises as a show of good faith to keep the negotiations moving. So that's one thing that people are looking toward in this round of talks. And then I think there'll be some incremental progress toward figuring out the architecture and the form of this new treaty meant to be agreed by 2015 and come into force by 2020.
Do you ever feel a little like it's still people are starting to move, it feels too little too late? Or does it seem like, given the pace of climate change, there's still time to, we're not going to turn it around, but to mitigate?
Well, actually, I think both of those things are true. So it would have been much better to start action at Copenhagen or even before. But every year of progress means that some human suffering and some ecosystem damage is going to be spared. So it would have been better to really get serious earlier, but it's also not too late. And our modeling shows that this goal of keeping temperature increase below 2 degrees is still within reach, but it really does require committed, focused action, turning to renewable energy and efficiency, deploying things we already know how to do. It also requires a focus on the other non-CO2 gases, particularly methane and nitrous oxide, which are also greenhouse gases. And then the other important part is limiting deforestation around the world, because that's another source of CO2.
Dr. Beth Solon is a writer, teacher. She is co-director of Climate Interactive. The non-governmental group has been doing some models on global energy systems and taking a look at the latest rounds of United Nations climate change talks this week in Doha, Qatar. Thank you for talking to us.
Thanks. I've enjoyed it.
Good morning, it's 10:21. You're tuned to 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. The last time you talked with your family, you either said, I love you, or you didn't. Later today, we'll take your phone calls on those three little words, and we welcome your thoughts right now at our feedback line, 206-221-3663. Do you hear, I love you a lot from family? Perhaps those words just aren't said in your family. Share your story, 206-221-3663. That's 221-3663. Then tune in this afternoon at 12:40.
Support for KUOW comes from TIAA CREF, helping people pursue their financial goals. Learn more at tiaacref.org/WA.
We have a mix of clouds and sunshine in Seattle, 44 degrees right now in the University District. Working towards a high of 49, forecast says it's going to be mostly sunny a little bit later today. Cloudy and cold tonight, the low in the upper 30s. We're expecting clouds and showers tomorrow, the high in the upper 40s.
This week, Seahawks cornerbackers Richard Sherman and Brandion Browner were notified that they tested positive for having taken a banned substance. They deny it, but could face a 4-game suspension. They say they will appeal and can play until the process plays out. Apparently, they were using a substance that contains chemicals found in Adderall. Adderall is on the NFL's list of banned performance-enhancing drugs. They join a growing list of players facing suspension for using the drug, including players from the Giants, the Bucks, the Browns, the Falcons. Commonly, it is prescribed to treat attention deficit disorder. So how does Adderall work as a performance-enhancing drug? Rick Figler is a sports medicine physician at the Cleveland Clinic. Dr. Figler, thanks for talking to us.
No, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, first of all, a little more about just what Adderall does for a person who needs it. What is Adderall and what does it do for the person who has ADD?
So Adderall is basically an amphetamine-like substance. And for people that do have ADD, it tends to control their thoughts and increases their cognition so they can think a little bit more clearly. For those that don't have ADHD, sometimes it's used or can be used as more of a stimulant. Think of mega doses of cups of coffee to try and stimulate someone to have a little bit more energy to complete whatever task it is that they're trying to complete.
So is it working just like cups of coffee on people who are, you know, football players?
It's a great question. You know, as far as the cups of coffee goes, you know, I think we all that do indulge in that early in the morning know that if we're not using it, we can kind of sense a feeling of grogginess or not feeling as sharp as
light. You know what, Dr. Figler? We're gonna call you back, and we're gonna hang up and call you back. We got a funky line, so we're gonna just call you right back and see if we can't improve our conversation, the quality of our conversation. if that's all right. We are talking with Dr. Rick Figler, who's a sports medicine physician at the Cleveland Clinic. Here, we'll listen to a little music for a moment while Amina calls. Little adult acoustic music for you. That was nice. Little adult acoustic, little guitar playing. It's a little interlude in the morning call just to relax you. See, we're talking about banned substances and the like, but really, perhaps players just need to play louder music before they enter the field and a little calmer music after they're done and bringing themselves back down. Hey, that's live radio for you. She's still trying to get them. You know, we are. By the way, going to be joined by two of our gardeners. Willie Galloway's off, but Marty Wingate and Greg Rayburn will be here. And as you know, this week and then next week will probably be our last week for the gardeners for a couple months because it's winter. I think I'm going to ask them to do a special event, though, that we'll tape so we get a little closer to the holiday season. And we'll talk more about like special gifts for gardeners. Or we may do that next week if that's what you folks want. But this week we're just going to do a little discussion on what you're doing to wrap up your garden. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to talk again with John Meacham about Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson was such a contradictory character that it seemed worthwhile to talk about the basis of his argument, which is how did he wield power? What did Jefferson do to wield power? Why did he hire people to defame? Well, defame's too strong because he wasn't cute. He didn't get convicted of that. Why did he hire people to attack his opponents so vigorously in the elections of 1800? And we're also going to talk about funding Washington education. You may have heard Governor Gregoire talking a little bit earlier about the importance of finding $1 billion in the next biennium, 1.6 over time, to fully fund education in Washington State, money that we don't have at this point. We're going to talk with one of the people who sits on a panel that the governor has constituted that is supposed to find that money and figure out a political compromise between the Republicans and Democrats in the legislature and those other people who are trying to figure out how to fund education. We're going to talk to the Republican who's on that panel to see what good ideas he thinks we can do, we can implement. Okay, let's try this again. Rick Figler, sports medicine physician at Cleveland Clinic. How's that? Do we sound better to you?
You sound a lot better to me. I hope I sound better to you as well.
You do sound better. Good, good. That's the beauty of live radio. Sometimes we just got to fix it. All right, so let me ask you again about, I'm going to ask you that question about Adderall, since quite a few players at this point are facing or have been suspended for Adderall in their systems. Some of them are appealing, some of them are saying it's prescribed, but what could Adderall do for somebody in a sports situation, in a football situation, and they don't need the drug otherwise? What is the benefit of taking Adderall for them?
Sure. So Adderall, being the stimulant that it is, can do a lot of things for athletes, whether it's on game day or whether it's not on game day. You know, the NFL has a very long season with organized team activities, mini camps, and then the preseason, and then the long 20-week season or so with preseason and regular season. The medication in and of itself, acting as a stimulant, to get through workouts. There are some athletes that would take it to to get through a workout feeling that they would have more energy during the course of their workout. Other athletes taking it during team meetings so they can study game film or study their playbook more efficiently. So they feel like they're, you know, retaining more of their information. You know, it's a job and they need to perform. If they don't perform, they're going to be not with the team. On game day, it can be potentially used as a stimulant to have someone kind of amped up or sped up for the game, so to speak, so they can play with a little bit more energy, especially if they were having a down day or a down week. They may reach for it. In college athletes, you know, we know that some of the athletes use it in the college level, not only for, they may be diagnosed with ADHD and use it for their general studies so they can focus more. And across college campuses, as you're probably very well aware, it's kind of known as the smart pill to get them through finals. Bottom line is, any of those indications without a prescription, even if it is a prescribed medication and using it without the proper intentions, it's abuse.
No, you were quoted in an article in the Cleveland paper that it is absolutely a performance enhancing agent. How does it compare? It's listed alongside caffeine and cocaine in the NCAA's list of banned substances. How does it compare with other substances that might be coming onto the market or into people's attention now? Is it pretty benign, or is it up there with something like cocaine in terms of its impact on the body?
Yeah, I think what's belittled with all of this is the potential for risk of side effects. You know, this is a stimulant. It's going to potentially increase heart rate, increase blood pressure, and although the purpose of the medication is not necessarily to do that, you know, the side effects could also include, there's been case reports of heart attacks, psychosis with the medication as well. So it's not a benign medication. It's not taken without the potential risks. Even if it's taken for the first time on a game day, you could see ill effects that would take somebody from going on the field to being off the field just due to the side effects of the medication alone.
Dr. Figler, how widespread do you think this is in professional sports? I see that a NASCAR driver admitted to taking it. Is this the current drug of the moment?
Well, I think if you look at college campuses and you see the widespread use, and you know they've done different questionnaires, and there's anywhere from, you know, a 10% to 20% increased risk of use among athletes or among college students just to get through final exams. In Major League Baseball, when they put out the therapeutic use exemption, which is basically having a diagnosis of ADHD, means that you could take it for that purpose. When they implemented that, and that therapeutic use exemption was signed off by a physician who diagnosed somebody with ADHD, the number of people that were diagnosed with ADHD went from like 1% to 8% in Major League Baseball in 1 year. So, you know, ADHD does exist in about 4% of the general population. It's just a matter of, you know, who are the athletes that are identified specifically as having that, and who are the athletes that are not, that are using it as a performance-enhancing agent.
I guess I'm going to ask you an opinion question here. I mean, we have the whole scandal in professional cycling, and we have, as you mentioned, 108 exemptions in 2009 in baseball, 10% of Major League Baseball players now getting an exemption to take these drugs. These players on the Browns and the Giants, and now the Seahawks, being accused and facing suspensions for taking Adderall. Are they trying to plug a dam here that's already burst, and can they effectively police to keep all these different drugs out of players' systems?
I think you bring up a great point with cycling, and you know, there's the athlete in and of themselves, since the dawn of time, has looked for an edge, has looked for a gain in their performance to try to be a better athlete. And I think we're going to continue to see that. you look at accessibility, Adderall is fairly readily accessible for most people that know someone who has it. And you know, there are other substances that athletes will look to or turn to get that quote unquote edge. I think the NFL does a great job of trying to stay a step ahead of the athlete and identify those behaviors that are putting the athlete more at risk, and in order to level the playing field so everyone's on the same page. I think that there's always going to be another medication down the line that somebody's trying that they're seeing benefit from that they're going to pass along from one person to another. The job of the NFL and other governing bodies is to make sure that we're staying on top of and ahead of those individuals to make sure that we're developing the right tests to capture them at the right time.
The Seahawks cornerbackers Sherman and Brown are facing this four-game suspension. They're going to go through an appeals process, it looks like. Sherman said that he's something he's never done, and he was never taken anything that would cause him to be suspended under the NFL rules for performance-enhancing drugs. So perhaps he says the drug test was wrong. Perhaps he'll say he has the exemption. Perhaps he'll say, I didn't take it knowingly. Can you end up with something like Adderall in your system from taking some other medication or some other things?
I know that there are some studies that are out there that talk about the purity of other substances that others take and ingest in their body. The bottom line with any athlete is the medication, the substances that they put in their body, they are held accountable for. And if it is a multivitamin that is not NSF certified, then they are taking a risk of it not potentially being contaminated. But I know of no other ways to get Adderall into your system as opposed to taking Adderall itself.
So you're a sports medicine physician at the Cleveland Clinic. What conversations do you have with athletes about not taking substances, not to trying to get the edge? And more to the point, what kind of reaction do you get?
It's mixed. The very few athletes will bring the conversation up with you because they know that it's not the right thing to do. And if they do bring it up, it's usually in a very naive way of, I'm being pressured to take this. I don't want to take it. There are other athletes using it. Is it safe? Is it not safe? And a lot of these athletes, especially the younger athletes, a lot of it's about weight gain. And, of course, we push them towards the proper way to gain weight with, appropriate exercise and diet. Unfortunately, in America, we're always looking for, the pill that will cure all ills and make us bigger, stronger, faster within a week, as opposed to really working hard and diligent at it and doing it the right way, so to speak. Those conversations that are usually brought up in the office with our younger athletes are usually also with the parents involved as well. So it takes a special kid to come into the office to bring those things up, to be honest with you. And it's not, it's more talked about in the locker room than it is in the physician's office, I can tell you that much.
Yeah, because they have to figure out how to use it. All right, sir, I appreciate you talking to us.
Oh, I appreciate the time. I hope it was informational.
It was. It was indeed. Dr. Rick Figler is a sports medicine physician at the Cleveland Clinic. This week, Seahawks cornerbacks Richard Sherman and Brandon Browner were notified they tested positive for having taken a banned substance. They deny it, but they could face a four-game suspension. They say they'll appeal, and they could play until that process plays itself out. Apparently, they were using a substance that contains chemicals found in Adderall. This is Weekday.
Dolly Parton's story is literally rags to riches. From the coat of many colors her mama made for her to the top of the country music charts, she always knew she'd make it and told her high school class so.
The whole place laughed out loud. I guess I showed them, huh?
The secret? Dream more. I'm Neil Cohn and the inimitable Dolly Parton. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And I had the gift of imagination. I could change.
That comes your way at noon today on our second program service, KUOW2. You can learn more at KUOW2.org. Good morning. It's 10:40. I'm Andy Hurst.
Support for KUOW comes from the School of Teaching ESL, presenting an information session on training options to teach English as a second language in the U.S. or overseas at 7 p.m. Monday, December 10th in North Seattle. Details and registration at schoolofTESL.com.
We have a mix of clouds and sunshine, 45 degrees right now in the U District, working towards a high of 49. Forecast says it's going to be mostly sunny a little bit later today. Cloudy skies expected tonight, the low in the upper 30s. We're expecting clouds and showers tomorrow, the high in the upper 40s.
Support for KUOW comes from Evergreen City Ballet, presenting The Nutcracker December 1st through the 16th in three different venues. Clara and the Prince travel to the land of sweets, featuring mice that escape into the audience with falling snow and the Sugar Plum Fairy. Tickets at evergreencityballet.org.
Greg Rayburn's here. Marty Wingate's here. Willie Galloway's off. We're here to talk about gardening, gardens, traveling to gardens, enjoying a garden, wishing we had a garden, bringing a garden indoor, whatever is on your minds.
Going to Cornwall.
You're going to Cornwall.
Yeah.
Marty Wingate writes about gardens and travel at MartyWingate.com. She wrote a book, Landscaping for Privacy, and yes, you got some garden tour. You got some garden tour you're planning.
In May. And the couple that own a private garden we're visiting next May are visiting. They're visiting their daughter who works here at KUOW. So we're chatting away about.
Wait, you knew them before?
No, Becky caught me in the hall a couple of weeks ago and said, you know, my parents have a garden that's open for the National Garden Scheme in England. Maybe you'd like to go there because it's near Bude. It's very near Port Isaac, which is this place they film Doc Martin.
These are all places I do not know. Oh, Doc Martin.
You know Martin. Doc Martin. And well, so,
what does that mean, a National Garden Scheme?
There is a national program wherein private gardens can open for the public one or more days a year. And they raise money for charity. That's the whole point. And the gardens are vetted. There's a county committee that comes and looks at gardens that apply to be open. And so we get a private tour at their garden and a cream tea.
I'd like to say that sounds like a plot from Doc Martin.
It does, doesn't it? So this is the day we go to see where they film Doc Martin, and then we're going to go to a lovely private garden. So if anyone wants details about our tour next May, they can go to my website.
MartyWingate.com?
Yes, indeed.
Greg, where are you going to send people?
Oh, well, I would send them to the Native Plant Salvage this weekend out in by Black Diamond. I put information on it on the Facebook page and where folks can go out and dig up native trees and shrubs.
What's going to go there instead?
Lots of houses, I believe.
Good.
It's a big, big new development out there. So it's a chance to go out there and volunteer for digging up plants that'll go to restoration projects and then also stay after and dig some additional plants to take home for yourself.
Maybe those folks will get native plants planted back in once the subdivision is built.
Yes, oftentimes that's the case.
Greg Rayburn is Vashon Basin Steward, works on habitat restoration and salmon recovery. How the salmon doing there on Vashon and Maury Island? Anything good happening this season?
It's been an exciting year. There's a local paper has covered the salmon run, and I've been down to Judd Creek and seen some coho spawning as well as some chum, and counted a lot of reds, which are the salmon nests that are left in the gravel. So it's been an exciting year, which I can't say some of the last few haven't been that exciting. But this year seems – I don't have any concrete numbers as far as numbers of runs and numbers of fish seen yet. But it's been fun to watch. And the community's been really excited about it, and it's really fun to see that enthusiasm around it.
You know, the governor said that one of her disappointments was that the cleanup on Puget Sound hadn't proceeded as quickly as she'd hoped. I was wondering if you feel that the community efforts by – your groups, by a Puget Sound Restoration Fund to put oysters in small bays around the sound, do you think that's what's bearing fruit? Do you think that's why you're seeing a success at the grassroots level?
Well, I think you can find some
success. The water up.
Yeah, I think you can find that at the streamside level.
Streamside,
you can find enthusiasm and support, but there's so much to do, and it can't be all these different groups are working hard and they're making progress, but I can't base the return of salmon this particular year on any given success, because next year may totally drop off. I mean, salmon runs work that way.
They do.
So it's kind of like monitoring the weather. You have to look at the long-term trend rather than individual years.
Of course, part of your efforts have been in the eelgrass beds and the nursery beds mm-hmm. around Vashon and Maury Islands. Any growth? So any increase in those or any decrease in those due to development that you've seen?
Not that I'm aware of, no. And most of my efforts are focused on preserving, protecting what we have now. There's been some efforts to reestablish eelgrass. I'm not sure if historically on Vashon, but in other parts of Puget Sound, and it's really challenging. It's more if the site conditions are there and the eelgrass patches can expand. But if there's things like water quality and a bunch of other things that can impact whether or not the eelgrass is able to survive.
All right. Our number is 206-543-5869. If you have questions for our gardeners, 1-800-289-5869. They're waiting for you to call. You have also emailed weekday@kuow.org. Stanley wants to know if it's too late to plant garlic in Seattle. If not, I want to plant it today. Where can I get some? He needs to go to the store.
He needs to go to the store. Yeah, he could go to. I'm sure some nurseries still have garlic
sets
left, don't you think?
Yeah, possibly. And same with Farmer's Market. And embarrassingly enough, the garlic that I said I was going to plant 2 weeks ago is still.
You don't.
I did transplant a bunch of trees. I garden. I just didn't get the garlic in, darn it.
But he can still put it in the ground.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
It'll just be ready later.
Not much later.
Not much?
Yeah. No.
Yeah. All right. So we can just be planting garlic right now.
Yeah.
All right. Good. Anything else? Could we plant shallots or onion sets too?
Shallots, yes.
All right. Good. We have newly planted 6 months ago Japanese stewardia that has buds right now. Wondering if this is normal for this tree this time of year, or is the relatively warm weather causing it to think it's spring? That's from Diane.
Well, I would say that probably the leaves have fallen and probably turned a lovely color. They have really nice orange and red shades. And if you look closely at almost any deciduous tree, you will see buds now. They're just ready. I doubt that they're going to open unless this was a case of the leaves dropping early because of lack of water and then it's trying to sprout again. But I don't think that's the case. I think that those buds are just going to be there until next year.
And some plants have what we call naked buds. They look like they're ready to burst, even though when they're not. They're not all tightly closed up.
All right. Here's an email with a picture attached, but you cannot see the picture, so I will describe it. A very persistent woodpecker got after our beautiful ornamental cherry tree the day before Thanksgiving. Before we could do anything about it, the bird had girdled the tree. I've read online about grafting a bridge over the wounds, but really don't know how it's done. So that we have this picture of this tree, and it's that woodpecker did do a pretty good job of just going right around that tree and just gouging out all the upper bark. But it's such a big tree. Would it really be, unless it's going all the way around, looks like an old tree. It's like about a 30-year-old, 40-year-old cherry tree.
Yeah, and oftentimes those wounds don't actually go all the way down. I can't quite tell by that picture whether or not they go all the way through the cambium layer, which could be fatal. But the it's amazing. I mean, right now, the friendly neighborhood bucks are coming through, and once I get these trees just perfectly established at the 6-year stage, then they come through and just take their racks and strip them off. And it's been amazing to see how much of the bark can be gone on a tree and still have it survive.
Looking
at that picture, yeah, definitely wait.
Why would the woodpecker be doing that?
I don't know why they did that. That's a very strange pattern.
That is a weird pattern. Is your implication that there's a lot of bugs in that tree right there?
Well, I would think he was looking for something.
Yeah, they could be. There could already be insect damage, definitely. It could be a weakened tree that was weakened by disease.
It looks like a...
But
like
it's
a
really weird...
3 or 4 inch pattern of damage around that tree. That bird was persistent.
It looks like a groove.
Is there a way? It does. Is there a way? Have you ever heard about this, bridging a wound? And
No, I haven't. And most of the products that they try to sell you as far as wound dressing, you're better off just letting the tree heal itself. They haven't been shown to actually increase survival. So I wouldn't bother buying products.
All right. Please tell Greg, Stephanie writes, that I followed his advice from last spring. I planted a salvage native honeysuckle next to my huge non-native zombie horse chestnut snag. It did well over the summer and started growing upward. I can't wait to see what happens next spring. Thanks for the idea.
Great. I was covering my...
I know, you were worried.
I was worried.
No, people got a salvage native honeysuckle, yeah. So they're doing the work.
And the hummingbirds will follow.
Yes, and the hummingbirds will follow. All right, our number is 206-543-5869 if you have some gardening questions or some political questions for Greg Rayburn or Marty Wingate. With the Galloways off, Judith is on Capitol Hill. Hi, Judith.
Hi there.
I
have a Cotinus, which has got a lot of dead leaves and on a couple of different branches. But when you snap the branches, it looks like there might still be some sap in there. And I'm just wondering, it might come back in the spring. It looks pretty horrible right now with all these curled up dead leaves.
When did the leaves dry up?
When did they dry out? Oh, maybe a month ago. It's like when it started being fall and, you know, leaves were starting to turn, but these ones turned, I mean, half the tree has a really nicely colored leaf that still looks alive but turning, and then half the tree has these horribly curled up black.
Yeah, and if they're all coming from the same, often smoke trees are multi-trunked, if they're all coming from the same branches, you may want to trace that down to see if there's any damage to a large stem. That just to see if there's a reason for it. These are pretty tough shrubs usually, and I cut mine back hard every spring just because otherwise it would take over the garden, and it comes out just fine. So
I actually came outside to look at it.
Oh,
I don't
okay.
see any damage.
Hmm.
And then if I snap, I mean, is snapping the leaves and looking if they have any color inside, does that tell you anything? They look
no.
kind of.
It wouldn't tell me anything. Not the leaves, but
doesn't tell me anything.
So yeah. So if you don't see anything untoward, I would just wait until it leafs out next spring, and then you may want to. If there are some branches that don't leaf out at all, you can cut those back.
Okay.
Of course, it doesn't leaf out until almost May, so it's kind of late. But keep an eye out.
Thank you. By the way, how much cutting back do you do on that tree? Do you really prune it hard?
Yeah. I have
some multi-stemmed tree, right?
Race, yes. And I have that golden one, Golden Spirit, I think it's called, which is hidden from view at the moment by this monster clematis. But for Cotinus grace, I cut it back to about 2 to 3 feet high every year just because I don't have the room. And it never blooms with those frothy, smoky blooms. But that's okay. That's not why I planted it. I planted it for the leaves. So.
All right. Fred's in Greenwood. Hi, Fred.
Hello. Yeah, I should be putting my garden to bed, but this Friday I'm going to be starting a new garden. On Friday. Part of the Just Garden Project, which builds vegetable gardens for people who couldn't have them otherwise. And we're going to be building two raised beds at a Ballard low-income seniors apartment complex. So we've got donated soil. We've got the frames to raise the beds up to wheelchair height are already made. And actually this afternoon we'll be tearing out the grass, the turf that's there. And then on Friday we'll have the truckload of dirt and a bunch of volunteers. And if things go well, by 4 o'clock We'll have some already started winter vegetables, kale and such, planted in them, and some garlic starts going.
How are you going to mulch that? Just thought I'd ask.
Probably put a coating of leaves over it, just, you know, whatever's available, and then some burlap perhaps to hold it down.
Go ahead.
Oh, so if you are, these are raised beds that are 2 feet high, I think you said. If you're dumping that much soil on them, you don't have to worry about digging that grass out, that's for sure. In the middle of the raised beds, you don't have to dig the grass.
Oh.
I like to be very cautious around grass that creeps up into things. I don't think I've ever seen it come up 2 feet, but I'm sure it's trying to.
I made a raised bed, a 12-inch raised bed once, and the grass has never returned to that area.
Yeah, so that'd be some vigorous grass.
I laid newspaper down.
Ah, but you still have to cut away from the area where you're putting the bed frames in, right?
Around the, oh yeah, edging. Oh,
yeah.
Oh.
Well, Fred, good.
That's a great project.
Just Garden Project.
Yeah.
That he got me thinking about projects. And so this would, transplanting kale like that, they like that enough? They'll be okay with that?
Well, if the kale has been in pots and it's outside,
sure.
And you're putting it in the bed, yeah, no problem.
All right. Our number is 206-543-5869. I probably got time for one more call. John, besides John, you just were thinking about salmon habitats?
Well, listening to Craig, I always get confused. If it's Greg or Craig.
Greg, with a G.
In 97, I've been just cutting the grass. I got some grass established in this area, Mount Index, Riverside's here. It's just clay and sand, silt. Hardly any rocks in the soil in general. It's more like a mud flow, you know, but they have all these lots and the banks of the creeks. I live on actually three creeks come together on the corner of my lot. One goes east-west, another one curves around, and one comes through the lot. And just cutting the salmon berries, the shrubs and stuff down and giving the ground cover a chance to grow, and raking the leaves, the maple leaves, just trying to keep the grass established, has saved me, you know, from the banks sloughing in.
Well, because go ahead.
Because usually the things like salmonberry and shrubs and trees do a much better job of holding banks than grass. Grass does a better job than bare soil, but just about any of the deeper rooting species will help hold banks better, as well as provide stream cover and other salmon habitat benefits.
Because they're leaning over the edge of the... the stream, right? The salmonberry and the like.
And they also support a wide diversity of native insects that will then fall into the water or fly inadvertently into the water and then are consumed by the
And you
the
have a variety
salmon.
Of root systems, types of root systems.
Yeah, for different depths, because different plants, some will go deeper than wider, other ones will spread really wide. Salmonberry is fantastic at holding banks.
Hence it being the native plant that's there often, right?
Yeah.
All right, John, thanks. Diane, real quick, I got a last question from you. Thanks for calling.
Is it too late to cut back the runners on my Italian plum tree, or will it get frost damage by doing that now?
You could cut them back now, but the tree will still have a lot of energy to burst into new growth with water sprouts and all sorts of things next spring. So if you wait until next summer and cut them back, you will get fewer growing back.
You hope.
Yeah.
Marty Wingate and Greg Rayburn are our gardeners. They'll be back next week, too. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks for your phone calls, your emails. This show is put together by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amin Al-Sadeh, Alexander Garrettin, Daniel Anthony Goodwin, Andy Hurst. I'm Steve Scherr. We'll talk to you tomorrow. This is Weekday.
Good morning. It's 10:59. We'll get an update from NPR News coming up next.
Support for KUOW comes from Chinook Book, featuring goods and services from more than 500 local merchants in Seattle and the Puget Sound area, dedicated to building an economy that supports small businesses helping community organizations. More at chinookbook.net.
Even wealthy universities now want more students who can pay their own way. Schools say rising financial aid costs are hurting education quality.
We don't get in a room and say, okay, do we give more aid here or do we give a raise to our professor over here? But behind the curtain, that's what's happening.
Colleges rethink financial aid later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That story and much more today from 3 until 6:30. This is 94.9 KUOW FM Seattle, 1340 Tumwater, 90.3 KQOW Bellingham.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.